So this evening we get back together to discuss the parshas of Tazria and Metzora. And these two parshas, of course, have many halachas, but they deal in the main with the topic of Tzaras. And there's much discussion with regards to many aspects of what Tzaras is. We know that it comes, as the Gemara says and the Medrash elaborates, as a punishment for various Averas. There's 7 or 10. The most well-known among them, of course, is Lashon Hara. And there's a well-known discussion among the Mefarshim as to whether Tzaras is a contagious disease, or is it absolutely contained within the person who has done the speaking of the Lashon Hara? There is a concept of Tzaras with regards to the nations of the world. We know, for example, that Naaman famously, that's the Haftarah for Parshas Tazria, which is almost never read, but he's an Assyrian general. He has Tzaras. So there certainly exists something that the Pasuk will call Tzaras for nations of the world as well. But some say this is exactly the difference between them, that for the Ummos HaOlam, so Tzaras is much more of a natural disease and it is contagious. Whereas for the Tzaras that our Pasuk is talking about, it's not absolutely distinct. But nonetheless, that's not something that's contagious. As long as you don't catch Lashon Hara from the person, you won't catch Tzaras from the person. And a proof that is offered in this regard is from a very interesting halacha, which is mentioned in the Mishnah in Maseches Nagoyim. The Gemara cites it. And that is, sometimes we delay. As we know, the person who thinks that he has symptoms of Tzaras, he needs to approach the Kohen. But there are times when we defer the appointment and we tell him to go home and we'll see him another time. And a classic example of this is Chasan b'mei Chasunoso. For the 7 days that someone is just gets married. So in order not to ruin everything, so we give him the week, and then the Kohen will see him in a week's time. So says the Mishnah, which is very interesting, because he will be coming into contact with people the whole time. Over the course of the Sheva Brachos, he may end up contaminating everyone who he sees that week. And clearly, or seemingly, that is not a concern. Interestingly, just on this Nakuda, this famous idea that the Chosan during the 7 days of the Sheva Brachos, so we give him the week off, the Gera Rebbe, the Imre Emes, who is the son of the Sfas Emes, asks an interesting shaila. It's well known that when a person gets married, all their sins get forgiven. Chosan is Mochlino al Kolabonoso. We actually learn it from Esav, of all people. His wife is called Mochlas, which the Medrash Darshan says, Mechila Rashi quotes it in Parshas Vayishlach, that the well-known idea that a Chosan, on the day he gets married, all of his sins are erased. Well, if that's the case, then why does he have Tzaras in the first place? I mean, unless it happened at the wedding, he spoke Lashon Hara about one of the guests, or so on. The in-law, certainly not. But how does he get Tzaras? But the Imre Emes says, the answer is that a person's wedding, we say, is like Yom Kippur. But as we know, the situation with regards to Yom Kippur itself is that it doesn't work for Averus that are ben Adam lechaveru until a person appeases the one that he upset or wronged. And that being the case, even if it's true that he got married and he's a chosan, it's no more than Yom Kippur, and if he hadn't asked for mechila, even his wedding wouldn't help. And we assume that the people that he asks mechila for, or needs to ask mechila for, were not on the list of those invited to the wedding. And therefore he can continue to have Tzaras, but we don't look at his Tzaras for another 7 days. Why is there no fear of contamination? This is one of the proofs that is cited by the Mefarshim, that the tsaras, as comes as a punishment for averos, is not a contagious disease. And therefore, until we look at him, and even after we look at him, there's no need for anyone else to have any fear of contracting tsaras. But because it's much more a response and a punishment for his averos, it's for this reason that the person that he goes to be treated, is the Kohen. Not the doctor, but the Kohen. As the Pasuk says, in the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel, if a person will have any of these discolorations, he'll be brought to Aaron HaKohen, and the question is, why is he brought to the Kohen? This is not Korbanos, this is not Trumas and Maisras. He has an issue. Why does he go to the Kohen? And the Sforno discusses this, and in his measured words, as always, the Sforno says, because the Kohen is traditionally the one who offers, in addition to doing the Avodah, Kisifse Kohen Yishmeru Das, he cites the Pasuk in Malachi, that the Kohen is also the teachers of the Jewish people. And says the Sforno, when he comes to the Kohen is the one who treats the symptoms, because the Kohen will do other things as well. He will encourage him and exhort him to examine his ways. He'll give him Musar, which is also part, if he really wants to be cured, he has to do a Cheshbon Nefesh. That's in the realm of the Kohen. The doctor doesn't normally tell that to a person. He treats the whatever the condition is. But here, the underlying condition is Lashon Hara or whatever it is. That's in the domain of the Kohen to talk about it. And moreover, says the Sforno, he will also tell the person to daven, and the Kohen will daven for him as well. It's a very interesting combination. Part of his instruction to the patient, so to speak, is that he tells the patient, you need to mend your ways and you need to daven. But then the Kohen also davens for him. I think in our experience, we're more used to an either or. As if to say, a person either takes the route that he'll daven for himself, in which case he's not going to ask someone else, or he outsources it to someone else entirely. He finds someone who knows how to do these things, and then he doesn't need to do any of the davening. But we see from the Sforno that in the end, it's a combined effort. Of course, if there's someone who is on a higher spiritual level and one can ask them to daven for them, great. That's works together with a person's own tefillah. It's interesting. The idea of having someone daven for you, as a tzaddik or so on, is actually sourced in the Gemara. But the Gemara doesn't explicitly say that. The Gemara says in Maseches Bava Basra, in the 8th Perek, that if a person, lo aleinu, is someone that has sick at home and who needs tefillos, he should go to a chacham. Interestingly, the Gemara doesn't say he should go to a tzaddik. We assume the Chacham is a tzaddik, but the Gemara doesn't say he should go to a tzaddik. He says he should go to a Chacham, to a Torah scholar, and that's what he should do. But the interesting shaila is, he should go to the Chacham for what? And here, there are two approaches among the Mefarshim. Rabbeinu Gershom, and we have a perush from Rabbeinu Gershom on Maseches, Bava Basra says he should go to the Chacham and ask the Chacham to daven for him. We assume that the Chacham is on a higher stature, and his prayers will be more effective, and therefore this is the source in the Gemara for asking a higher person to daven for your issues. At the same time, though, the Meiri says that he should go to the Chacham, and the Chacham will teach him how to daven. In other words, the Chachma here is not that the Chacham will do his davening for him, but rather he'll teach him the best way to go about it. So interestingly there, it takes the form of a machlokas. Who should do the davening? The special tzaddik or the person himself? As far as the Sforno is concerned, this is not a binary thing, and neither is exclusive of the other, and both of them should be involved in this. But the more we see the spiritual role of the Kohen within treating the Tzaraas, and not just saying, it's Tomei, it's Tahor, you can go home, you can't go home. It's more that he's involved in the spiritual rehabilitation of the person and davening for him. Perhaps that will help us understand the phraseology of the Pasuk, which I think is, I don't know if it's unique, but certainly unusual. Because in our terminal, in our phraseology, we would say, if a person has Tzaraas, he goes to the Kohen. But the Pasuk doesn't exactly say it in such simple terms. It says in the end, once again, Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Beis, Adam ki yeh b'or b'saro se'ei so sapacha so b'heres. So he has these discolorations, v'haya b'or b'saro l'nega tzaras. So who should he go to? Or interestingly, in the words of the Pasuk, who should he be brought to? V'huva el Aaron ha-Kohen. He should be brought to Aaron, O el achad mi banav ha-Kohanim, or to one of his sons, the Kohanim. And as we've seen in Vayikra, which is Torah's Kohanim, it's all about the Kohanim. Sometimes it will refer to just Aaron, and we assume that that represents all Kohanim. Other times it refers to the Kohen, and that's a Kohen. And it might call him B'nei Aaron ha-Kohanim, and so on. But I think it's very unusual that the Pasuk says, mentions both of them in the sense that you can go to Aaron or to one of his sons. If you can go to one of his sons, so then just say go to the Kohen. His sons are effective here because the Kohanim, so just say Uvo Ela Kohen, which is how the Pasuk will refer to it for the balance of the Parsha. The Kohen will see, the Kohen will say. But in the very beginning, it almost sounds like Aaron has a pride of place here, but the other, his sons are also acceptable. But why is that so? And we don't find this in other areas. And perhaps could it be that once we see that the extent to which the Kohen is involved in the process of the Mitzorah, one might have thought maybe you should go to Aaron specifically. Maybe Aaron's tefillos are more effective than those of his sons, and maybe his moral instruction will be more effective than those of his sons. So it could be that's why the Pasuk really needs to spell out, and maybe it's really true, ask for Aaron. But if not Aaron, the other sons are certainly acceptable. But we understand why there's two tiers in the terms of the people that a person should be approaching. So these are some introductory comments with regards to Tzaraas, contagious, not contagious, the Kohen, why the Kohen. And this brings us to discuss a question that we have spoken about on a number of occasions over the years, namely, the difference in order between the types of Tzaraas as they are ordered in the Pasuk and as they happen, would happen to a person, by which we mean there are three types of Tzaraas. There's Tzaraas that happens to the person, the body of the person. There is Tzaraas of a person's clothing and Tzaraas of the home. And in the Pasuk, that is the order in which they appear. First are all the types of Tzaraas of the person, then Tzaraas of the clothing, and then Tzaraas of the home, which is in Parshas Metzorah. The first two you have in Parshas Tazria, and the third in Parshas Metzorah. As we know, and the Rambam describes it based on the Medrash, if a person would ever be deserving of Tzaraas, the order is reversed. The first thing to be affected are the walls of the house. And if he gets the message, then all well and good. And if not, then whatever happens to the house happens. And at that point, if he persists in Lashon Hara, so then things get, I wouldn't exactly use the phrase closer to home, that's a bit of a sore point by that stage, but the Tzaraas will come upon his clothing, and if he still doesn't get the message, Tzaraas will come upon the person. So the order that it would actually happen is the opposite of the order that the Torah writes it in, and the question is, what are we to make of this? And there's many, many explanations given by Rishonim and Acharonim. But apropos of our discussion, A very interesting approach is to be found in the Sefer Ben Melech, Rabbi Meir Mintzberg, and it's based on the Rambam. Here we are saying there's three types of tzaras, and we also say that tzaras isn't really related to any type of medical condition. It's its own thing, and it's not contagious, and it's absolutely a response to Lashon Hara and other averas. That may well be true. But at the same time, the fact remains that when it comes to a person's body or their skin, there are physiological conditions that can lead to discolorations within the skin that do not really exist with clothing and with stones and so on. The body can do that. And this is noted by the Ramban. And interestingly, says Ramban, there is a phrase that we find with tzaras of the body that you don't find with regards to the other two types of tzaras, clothing or home. And that phrase is refua, healing. It will refer to, if tzaras clears up within a person, it's called nirpa hanega. The nega has been healed. And if the nega has been healed, that really is emphasizing that at the end of the day, we are dealing with something that impacts on the person's body, as opposed to the clothing and the house, where there isn't really even a basis for discoloration. Things do not spontaneously just change color, but for a person, often they will, due to various things. And before we get to answer our question, to come back to with regards to the order of the types of tzaras, Rav Mintzberg explains based on this, and again, the halachas of tzaras are many and detailed, but one thing to take note of, which is really explicit in the pasuk, and that is you can have these two types of tzaras, namely of the body and of clothing, the very same thing can happen to them, and in the one case, it will be declared pure, and in the other case, impure. By which we mean, in a situation where when the symptoms first arise, the Kohen might look at it and might quarantine the person for 7 days, and then after 7 days, there's been no change, he quarantines them again. After the second set of 7 days, if there's still been no change, meaning it hasn't diminished, then it hasn't increased. It stayed the same for 2 weeks. The question is it Tomei or is it Tahor? Well, let's see. In Parshas Tazria, in the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel, which deals with tzaras of the skin, so if we start with Pasuk Vav, meaning we're getting to the end of Pasuk Hey, already describes the second quarantine, V'yizkiroa Kohen Shivas Yomem Shenis, and then Sheni. And then, Pasuk Vav, V'ra'a Kohen Oso Bayom HaShvi'i Shenis. So he's been quarantined twice. There were symptoms and they didn't get bigger or smaller. And after the second quarantine, V'inei Keha HaNega, V'lefasa HaNega Ba'or, it hasn't increased in size. V'tiharo HaKohen, the Kohen declares the person tall. So apparently, the moral of the story is, after 2 weeks, if it hasn't gotten bigger, it's okay, you're tall. But if we move towards the end of the Perek, and most of Parshas Tazria is Perek Yud Gimel, if we move to Pasuk Nun Hei, which is already Tzaras of clothing, so here again, Pasuk Nundalad has given us the second quarantine, V'hiskiro Shivas Yomim Shenis. And then, Pasuk Nunhei, V'ra'a HaKohen Acharehu Kabeses HaNega, after it's been washed and etc. V'inelo Afach HaNega Eseino, V'anegalo Fasa, it hasn't changed color and it hasn't gotten bigger. Tomehu. That garment is Tomei. So putting these two psukim together, which is very easy not to do, because there's 40 psukim apart, and we have our hands full each time, but putting these two psukim together, we see exactly the same experience. It's gone 2 weeks, there has been no enlarging, And in the case of the person, it's tahor. In the case of the garment, it's tamei. Why? So if Mintzberg said, here we see the meeting, we could almost say, the meeting of the unique phenomena called tsaras with the physiological reality of a person's skin. As if to say, at the end of the day, it becomes a physical condition. And physical conditions, if they're there to stay, they tend to spread. So given the nature of a physiological condition, if it hasn't spread, that means that it's not tummy. Because if it was, it would. So for things to stay when you'd expect it to spread and they don't, that's tahor. But when it comes to garments where there is no basis of spreading or anything like that, if it's the same size and it hasn't gone away, that's the Torah's way of saying it's here to stay, and that's all there is to it, and that garment is tamei. So it's interesting to see how on the scale, if we may say, of the supernatural nature of tsaras, it has a natural base within tsaras of the person. Clothing and houses, no natural base whatsoever. And taking all of this on board, we come back now to the order of the parshas. There is a rule that many mefarshim mention in different contexts. The way in which the Torah will choose to order the things that it introduces is what is called lozu afsu. Lozu afsu means not only this, but even this. As if to say, we begin with the entity that is easier, less of a chiddush, so to speak, more natural. And then we progressively introduce more and more unnatural things or bigger chiddushim. Lozu afzu. Not only X, but even Y. Not only the relatively more intuitive, but even the more counterintuitive. And therefore, once we understand that the notion of tsaras within the skin of a person, which could change color anyway for other reasons, not tsaras related, so all of the three types of tsaras of the skin is the most intuitive, it's the easiest to relate to. And that's why it's mentioned first. And once it's mentioned first, so then that sets the order for the moving outwards in that regard. So for the chiddush factor, it starts with tsaras of the person, then the clothing, and with the house. All of this changes when it comes lemaisa, because we assume that tsaras of the body is the worst of all of them, and therefore as an act of rachmanus, Hashem starts from the outside and moves in towards the person. That's the practicalities of the matter, but that's why you have this disparity in the order between how things would happen practically based on rachamim concerns and how they are ordered in the Torah based on chiddush concerns. So these are the comments of Reb Leib Mintzberg, and what's very interesting is we normally take this as well as a kind of a binary discussion. Tsaras, natural, unnatural. But here we see that in a sense it's not monolithic, because some have more of a natural base, others less so, and that there are tiers within the different types of tsaras themselves. If we move a little closer to the issue of Lashon Hara itself, the Rambam has a famous conclusion of the halachas of tsaras. He goes through all of the halachas. They are famous as a body of halacha, Negoim. And in the end, the Rambam, he talks about Miriam, about how much we should learn from Miriam, how mild her Lashon Hara was, and even so she got punished, and how much more so everyone else who has none of her excuses and so on. But in the course of his words, the Rambam says that it's the way of things, that people who speak divrei havai, worthless matters, and very interestingly, the Rambam says Lashon Hara often doesn't begin with something negative. malevolent. It's people just speaking things which are of no purpose. Divrei Havai. Says Rambam, from speaking Divrei Havai, people come to speak ill of tzaddikim. And that's very interesting for a couple of reasons. Firstly, the Rambam here is focusing on Lashon Hara about tzaddikim. Now, as we know, Lashon Hara doesn't need to be only about tzaddikim. As a concept, it can be about anyone. But there seems to be a special niche of Lashon Hara that's reserved for tzaddikim. And it starts by people who speak meaningless things. How does A lead to B? And perhaps the understanding is that if a person uses the faculty of speech for worthless things, for meaningless things, for valueless things, then in a sense, there is the presence of a tzaddik or the existence of a tzaddik who spends their time with valuable things and with meaningful things and who uses the faculty of speech for productive purposes and for holy purposes and for elevated pursuits. All of that stands now as an indictment on the emptiness of the person who is using the faculty of speech for no constructive purpose. People don't like to have an indictment directed at them, which means if a person is devoting their power of speech to Divrei Havai, to worthless things, in order to protect that, they will then deal with the tzaddikim who are raising a question mark on how they're using their power of speech, and to reduce them to not the tzaddik that you think they are. And the moral of the story is, don't ask me why I'm not more like the tzaddik Plony. He's not the tzaddik that you think he is, and therefore I'm allowed to get back to talking about whatever it is that I wanted to. And this is very interesting because it demonstrates to us that Lashon Hara sometimes is used in order for a person to protect themselves in, of course, the only in the negative sense of the word, from any moral questioning that may have. If the shaila is, how can you be like that? Why can't you be more like so-and-so? My only answer to that will be, well, if only you knew so-and-so the way I do, you would never ask a question like that, and he should really be more like me, but you can never really change people. And this now broadens out this idea that sometimes speaking Lashon Hara about someone is because I need to bring them back to a place where they're not a threat to me, either a moral threat or maybe otherwise. Very often, if someone seems that they are getting more of the attention than I think that they should deserve, more honor that I think that they should deserve, because the honor is really reserved for me, and they are now usurping something and the focus and so on, so I will deal with them and put them down in order that everything should return to exactly the way it should be, all honor due to me in the center, and the person is back in orbit around me where they really belong in the first place. And all of this, therefore, is based on the person's expectations as to what should be coming to them and who is now encroaching on them and taking something that is not theirs, and that's the whole pursuit of Lashon Hara. But the matter goes one stage further. One of the psukim that describes the experience of the Mitzora is Pasuk Memhei, Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Memhei. Which says, that tsarua asher bo hanega. So the tsarua, who has this affliction, begadav yufurumim, his clothes should be torn, v'roshoye farua, and his head should be untrimmed, his hair has to grow, he can't cut his hair, v'alsafam yaten, he covers his face until it covers the most of his face till his upper lip, and we'll come back to that, v'tomei tomei yikra, and he needs to call out, "Tommy, Tommy." So as he's leaving town, going into his isolation, he needs to call out along the way, "Tommy, Tommy," that he's impure. Why? To what end? And here we find two classic explanations. Rashi says, one could say very practically, he calls out that he's Tommy so that people should keep away from him. No one should come into contact with him. They shouldn't be, should get Tommy. At that stage, if he has Tzoras, they might not get Tzoras from him, but he's Tommy, and he could be Metame other people. So he needs to call out, "Tommy, Tommy," so people should keep away. The Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos, in the sixth perek, that he calls out that he's Tommy as he leaves town because he's really asking people to daven for him. Shivakshu olav racham, which is quite different than it's not so much keep away from me, and of course the two are not contradictory to each other, but different emphasis. For Rashi, it's keep away, and for the Gemara, it's keep me in your prayers, daven for me. So the people of town, many of whom, incidentally, he may have maligned with his Lashon Hara, are now also being listed in the Tefillah. From this foreigner we saw, it's the person himself, and the Kohen will daven for him, and now the people in town need to daven for him. Whatever it means, one thing is for sure. There's a great deal of shame that accompanies the Mitzora as he walks out of town. Declaring himself Tommy, Tommy, whatever it means, whether it means keep away from me because I'm Tommy, or daven from me because I'm Tommy, it's a very embarrassing situation. And in a sense, this too is part of what has to happen to the Mitzora. He needs to feel the reverberations of the damaging speech that he has merrily been indulging in, Lashon Hara, causing all forms of destruction. He needs to feel the reverberations. And a lot of it takes the form of this shame. And interestingly, this element of the shame of the Mitzora, the embarrassment of the Mitzora, is actually relates to a halachic question, which is discussed, was asked to Rav Waldenberg, Zatzal, and Tzitz Eliezer, Nechelek Yud Gimel. And he, of course, was asked many medical shaylos. He was the posik for Shari Tzedek. And there is a well-known practice. And that is that whenever, as a hospital, not every hospital, but was operating, there are medical students. And they will follow the doctor around, and they'll look at this patient and this patient. And sometimes the patient that they're looking at has undergone a procedure which might be either invasive or embarrassing, and all of a sudden there's a team of people that are looking at them. Is that acceptable? Is it appropriate? Can they be forced to submit to that? Or can it only be with their consent? It's an embarrassing situation. And then here's a group of strangers in a semicircle around them and discussing and so on. Now, one could say, obviously, that it's for the greater good of medicine. In other words, that's how they'll learn and so on. There's no question that that's what it's about. But are the feelings of the patient something that needs to be taken into consideration? And does their consent need to be given before this? And what if they disagree? What if they refuse? And Rav Waldenberg is actually of the opinion that one should ask for their consent. One should certainly try and explain to them how it's important and so on, but one should really not just take a liberty or make a presumption, but should really turn to the patient and get their consent. And in the course of his discussion, Rav Waldenberg refers to a netziv in the Hamik Dover, in Parshas Mitzora. And that's it in Pirik Yud Dalet, Pasuk Nun Zayin. And through this Netziv, as with discussed and expanded by the Rav Altenberg, the pasuk goes from Tsaras to the hospital ward. Pasuk Nun Dalet of Perek Yud Dalet are concluding psukim, one may say. Zos HaTorah L'chol Nega Tsaras V'Lanosek. This is the ruling, the halachos with regards to these type of Tsaras. V'la Tsaras HaBeget V'la Bayes V'la Seis V'la Sapachas V'la Beheres L'horos. To teach. B'yoma Tameh B'yoma Tahor, on the day that one will be declared Tameh or Tahor, Zos Teras Hatzaras. So the opening word of Pasuk Nun Zayin is Lahoros, to teach. To teach whom? And who's doing the teaching? We might understand the Pasuk is teaching, but then the Pasuk is always teaching. The Torah is always Mora. So why does it here, it says Lahoros, to teach? The Raivad, in his commentary to the Teras Kohanim, explains that Lahoros means that a mitzora can be used for teaching purposes. Lahoros. As if to say, if someone comes and has symptoms of tzaras, and the Kohen needs to know, is it Tommy, is it Tar? How's he going to know? He needs to have training in this field. How will he know what type of what looks like tzaras? He must have seen cases beforehand. Under whose auspices? A qualified Kohen himself. Which means, says the Raivad, that if a tzaras case comes, and it is Tommy, the Kohen, or the Talmid Chacham in conjunction with the Kohen, they will call the Talmidim around and teach them and say, You see what this person has? That's tzaras. This is the first example we have of someone really being looked at by students to learn. Says the Netziv, but it's very embarrassing. He thought this, what started as a private conversation between him and the Kohen has now become a public forum. And he is now the subject of everyone saying that this person has tzaras. Come and see, everyone look. Not everyone, but the students. Says the Netziv, yes, that's embarrassing. But that's part of the kapara of tzaras. Lahoros. But if that's true, then it sounds like this is only the case for a mitzora who really has done something wrong, and therefore he needs a kapara that will come through. This is similar to being walked out of town saying Tommy, Tommy, is that he needs to be looked at by the students, and everyone says, oh, that's tzaras. But that's why the pasuk concludes Zos tzaras hatzaras means this is true for tzaras, but it's not true for other things. No one else should be subject to that embarrassment. Now, one could say that maybe with other situations, it's less embarrassing because if a person has tzaras, it means they did an aveira. If a person needs to have some other medical procedure, that doesn't mean they did an aveira. It's less of a moral statement on the person to say this he has such and such a medical condition, but it can still be embarrassing. Either way, based on this Netziv's elaboration upon the Raivad and the Teras Kohanim, we see how Lahoros also becomes part of the experience of the mitzora. He becomes a teaching object. Either way, that's the shame of a Tomei Tomei Yikra, as we've explained it through Rashi and the Gemara. Once again, he calls out, quote, Tomei Tomei, meaning I'm Tomei, for any of those reasons. A very different approach to these words, V'Tomei Tomei Yikra, is to be found in the Shaloh HaKadosh. And he intones the words differently. Where is the quotation mark? We have put the quotation marks around the words Tomei Tomei, meaning, and, quote, Tomei Tomei, end quote, that's what he should call out. But the Shaloh HaKadosh says there's another meaning here, and it relates more to the root of the problem. Here's someone who has been pointing out other people's faults from morning till evening. Where does that come from? And why does he do that? Why does he say that so-and-so is impure? Because he's impure. an impure calls out impure. The way the Shalor reads the Pasuk is the Torah says, V'tome, the Tome person, quote, Tome, end quote. He calls out Tome. He will call out the Tumah in other people because it's an expression of the Tumah inside of him. And what does this mean? The Gemara says in Maseches Kiddushin, it's a well-known idea, and Daf Ayin, the words of the Gemara are very brief and to the point. Kol ha-posel, b'muma posel. Whoever disqualifies and denigrates people, they disqualify with something that's wrong with them, with something that's wrong with the disqualifier. And what that means is it's highlighting a propensity that if a person has something, he will see it in others, and rather than deal with it in himself, he'll call it out in others. That's how it pervades his vision, but he only sees it with other people. And the more people he can identify as having this, the less he needs to worry about it. But why does he see it with them in the first place? Of all the things that one could perceive within another person, what chooses which qualities one sees or how one interprets? The person himself? As we know, very often, someone who is dishonest will be mistrustful of people, because he naturally assumes that they will be the way he is. We find a classic example, the contrast of this idea, as the Mishnah in the fifth parak of Pirkei Avos famously talks about Avram and Bilam as really two opposites. Avram represents Ayin Tova, benevolent vision, and Bilam represents Ayin Ra'ah, negative vision. And where does it come from? Why does Avram look at people positively? And why does Bilam negatively? Because the type of person that Avram is, that's what he sees in other people. He sees their potential, their positivity. But someone like Bilam, who's only ever looking to get whatever he can through whatever means, that's what he assumes other people are doing. And it relates to the way that ultimately they connect with Hashem. When Hashem tells Bilam, don't curse the Jewish people, Bilam can't disobey, but he's not happy with Hashem's instructions because his whole mindset is, why is Hashem holding me back? Why is he not letting me succeed? Because it can't be for my own good. Why would anyone do something for someone else's good? Bilam would never do that, and therefore he imposes that on Hashem's instructions to him. And if Hashem says no, I'll do my best to turn the no into a yes. Because Hashem doesn't have my interests at heart. Why would he? I don't have his interests at heart, or anyone else's for that matter. But contrast that with Avram. When Hashem tells Avram, take Yitzhak and offer him up as a korban, Avram proceeds because Avram says, whatever Hashem tells him is for the best. I don't see how. I can't understand it. Because that's the type of person that Avram is. So very often what a person hears is what they are. What a person sees is what they are. There is a well-known pasuk in Mishle, Kamayim haponim laponim, kein lev ha'adam la'adam. Just like with water, face to face in the water, so too one person's heart with the other. The way that you relate to other people is the way that you'd relate to your face in the water. That's what the pasuk is saying in Mishle. And what does it mean? So the well-known, the commonly given explanation is that if you wish to change someone else's heart, the way to do it is how you change your expression in the water. If you look at your face in the water and you want it to smile, smile first and it will smile back. Kamayim haponim laponim. If you keep a sour face, it's not going to move. Kamayim haponim laponim, so too, if you wish to bring about a certain people act in a way that they are acted towards. So smile towards another person. You never know. There's a good chance they'll smile back. That's the generally given explanation. Reb Zalman of Elozhin, who was the younger brother of Reb Chaim, there were five brothers, and here's Reb Zalman, there's a famous biography of him called Toldos Adam. He passed away very young. He explains somewhat differently. If we hear the different inflection. Kamaim aponim aponim, the way that you relate to another person is the way that your face relates to its reflection in the water. What does that mean? It means that if you look in the water, there's another face there. But what do you see? It's your face. It's there, but what, everything you see is you. Kein leif ha'adam la'adam. So too, often, when you look at another person, what do you see within that other person? You. Everything they do, you interpret in terms of how you do things. So you're looking at yourself. And the things that you notice about them are things that are going on with you. So we often bring the landscape to the picture that we're looking at. Just like Kamaim Apanim Lapanim. Very thought-provoking explanation. And indeed, just coming back from after Pesach, Reb Shlomo Kluger famously addresses the famous question about Paro. Paro suspects the Jewish people of all manner of insurrection. He's just waiting. They're a fifth column, and as soon as there's a war, they'll align themselves with our enemies. They'll take over. They're just looking to choose their moment. As the Pasuk says in the beginning of Shemos, Pen Yerveh, the Jewish people are waiting to cause trouble and take over the country. And the Shaila, Asher Shlomo Kluger, is just like, does Paro really think that? Have the Jewish people done anything to make Paro think that they would actually do anything like that? And the answer, says Shlomo Kluger, is no. But he's still convinced that that's what they're going to do, for a very simple reason. They can't imagine that they would do anything else. That's what he would do. If you're Paro, you think power. And with all of that wealth that they're amassing and influence they're amassing, how can they not be looking to take over the country? I can't imagine another possibility there, because there's no question that that's what I would do. So ultimately, and this is of course the great irony, and it has been repeated many times, the things that the Jewish people are accused of are things that their accusers would do. That the Jewish people are not planning on doing that at all. So they have to deal with other people's faults now that are hoisted upon them. And in fact, just to bring it to the Haggadah itself, this pasuk of Paro's fears for the Jewish people, there'll be a war, is mentioned in the Haggadah in elaboration of the words Vayoreyu Osanu HaMitzrim, which we normally translate to mean that the Egyptians were evil towards us, Vayoreyu from the word Ra. Reb Shlomo Kluger explains that Vayoreyu is from the word Rea, peer, or fellow, or equal. Vayoreyu Osanu HaMitzrim, they made us like them. They related to us just like they related to themselves, which means they then suspected us of it, all the things that they would do. As it says, Havan Ischak Malo, and proceeds with the litany of all the terrible things that Jewish people will do. That's guilty by reflection. But none of it exists. And coming back to our pasuk, all of this is contained within the way that the Shalom HaKadosh intones these words. Tomei, Tomei Yikra. But if a person calls Tomei, that's an indication that there's tumah within the person. A Tomei person calls out Tomei, as the Gemara says, Kolaposel b'mumaposel. What that means is, if one speaks Lashon Hara about someone else, you don't necessarily learn that much about the other person that Lashon Hara is being spoken about. But you can often learn a great deal about the person who's doing the Lashon Hara speaking by the Lashon Hara they say about other people. It can be an illuminating experience in ways that they did not intend. So all of this, and these are tributaries to the chronic condition that is called tzaras, that comes through Lashon Hara, whether it's divrei havai, causing a person to tear down tzaddikim, or stum other people that are in their way, or because of tumah, and so on. But where does it lead the person? How dire is the situation? If we come back to Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Mem He, which describes the behavior and deportment of the Mitzora, Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Mem Hei. We say Bigadav Yufrumim, his clothes need to be torn. Veroshe Perua, his hair uncut. The Al Safam Ya'ate. Al Safam Ya'ate, the Safam is the upper lip. His head needs to be covered over until his face is covered till the upper lip. What is that? Rashi provides one word of explanation. Ke'ovel, like a mourner. This is a practice of mourning that in most communities it does not exist. The other things, lo aleinu, are still there, sitting on a low chair, etc. Teimanim, and maybe other Sephardim also. there's many different practices among Sephardim, but Teimanim I know do still have this practice. They have like their talis and it covers their face. And so he looks like a mourner. That's a different element altogether. So far, he's embarrassed, and he's a sinner, and he's many, many things, and he's tamei, and he's isolated. And another thing, he looks like a mourner. And the simple shaila is, who is he mourning? Who is he an oval for? And the answer, say the Mefarshim, is he's an avelis for himself. A metzora, says the Gemara, is considered like a dead person. And now we can understand why. He is so disconnected from the people around him. He can't actually see or hear anything that anyone is actually doing or saying, even if they're talking to him. He's in his own world, but he's not in the same world as inhabited by other people. No longer with us is why a metzora is considered kemes. He's deceased. And many of his halachas of tuma are so stringent, they are more in common with tumas mes than anything else. So it's an amazing situation. That's how bleak the matzav is for this person. He's reached a state where the mourner and the deceased are one and the same person. The good news is, he can get out of it. But until he does, he may as well be mourning the deceased. That's how not in the world he is. That's how not part of life he is. And that's why when David HaMelech begins, as we say in Pesukei Dezimra for Shabbos morning, to exhort people towards taking care of the things that they say, he begins by saying, Mi Yo'ish HaChafetz Chaim, who's the person who wants life. We normally just move to the answer, which is Netzor L'Shem Chameira. But what he's saying is, until a person takes care of this, they're not really part of life. Not fully. Perhaps not at all. For a person, a Chafetz Chaim, to be alive in the meaningful sense of the word, in this world. So that person is Netzor L'Shem Chameira. So all of these things, it's a great trauma for the Metzora. And rightly so. Saras is a serious business. And the Averas, such as Lashon Hara, that lead to it, are also a serious business. And actions have ramifications. But it's amazing to see, at the end of all of this, what happens to the Metzora. It sounds like he's been through everything. He's been paraded out of town, or he leaves and he announces, Tommy, Tommy, no one can go near him. But when he's finally ready to come back, Perek Yud Dalet Pasuk Yud, he has korbonos, and there's something very special, unique actually, about these korbonos. What are they? Perek Yud Dalet Pasuk Yud, Vayom HaShmini, he's got his first set of 7 days of coming back, and then the eighth day, Yikach Shnei Kevosim Tamimim, so he brings three animals, an ola, a chatas, and an asham. And, says the pasuk, ushlosha esronim, soles mincha bulula vashemen. And he brings three esronim of flour with these three korbanos. Why is he bringing three? Why is he bringing minchas? Why is he bringing meal offerings? Do they normally come just by themselves to accompany a korban? Says Rashi, Leniske Shlosha Kvosim Halado. It's for purposes of Nesachim, of the wine libations. Two of the korbanos of the Metzora are a chatas and an osham. The Mishnah says in Menachos, Chatasan and Asham never have a Nesach. They're never accompanied by Nesachim, by wine libations. The only exception are the Karbonos of the Metzorah. What are we to make of all of this? What's more, the Parsha of Nesachim hasn't even appeared in the Torah yet. That's not going to be till Parsha Shalach. So we're almost getting a preview. It's exceptional, and it's preemptive, and it's the last place you'd expect, because a Nesach, says the Gemara, is like the itur of a korban. It's the enhancement of a korban. And generally speaking, Chatasan and Asham, their korbanos don't deserve to be enhanced. It's pure. It's a very business type of korban. We're not looking for hidurim here. And that's true for all Chatas and Asham. And the exception is the most least likely case, the Metzorah. And why? Because after everything the Metzorah has been through, if he's really ready to correct his ways, the Torah welcomes him back. And when he's, after everything that he's gone through, when he brings his korbanos, the Torah receives it with favor. Hashem says that he bring a nesach for that korban. He should be welcomed back if he's been rehabilitated. What's in the past is in the past. And even the simple gesture, as the pasuk says, it's a word we could take it for granted. The Kohen goes out to meet him. Here's this Metzorah. He might think by this stage no one's going to come out to meet him ever again. All of his whole social standing is in ruins, and as with everything else. And the first thing he meets as he makes the lonely trudge back to town, the Kohen has come out to meet him, to receive him. Because if he's back, he's back completely. And what is a Chatasan and Asham for? If not to make a fresh start. And everyone deserves a fresh start, even the Metzorah. And therefore, his korbanos have the distinction of being the only mehudar, chatas and asham, as if to say, the person has done tshuva, he's made amends, he's made it up with the people that he spoke lashon hara with, etc., etc. Like everybody else, he's welcome back. On that positive note, we end our discussion for this evening. We should all continue only to have besuras tovos and yeshuos v'nechomos in a peaceful week in Hashem in Israel and beyond. All the best.